I'd like to start the meeting. I'd like to call the meeting for February 16th, 2010 to order. Please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call of members, please. Ms. Herrera?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer will be arriving later this evening. Mr. Lane?
Here.
Ms. McAsey?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Present.
Mr. Proto?
Here.
Ms. Pryor?
Here.
Mr. Robison?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk?
I'm here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
14 members present. I would like to begin tonight with a moment of silence, and I'd like to ask Frank to lead us in that.
Thanks, Madam Chair. For those of you that may have missed it, we lost yet another one of our members of this legislature about 2 weeks ago. Some of you will remember Florence Starr, who was the town clerk in Caroline, it seemed like forever. She was doing a brief stint as the town supervisor, and she was also a member of the town board, and I might add a very staunch Republican. But she filled this seat after Jimmy Miller stepped down for a short time from 1982 to 1984. She was my predecessor. And a very nice lady, very staunchly supportive of libraries, the youth services, human services in general, but also a very fiscally conservative individual. And she was the first woman to serve in a leadership capacity. She was the first vice chairman of this board that was a lady, that was a woman. And I would appreciate it if you might honor her with a moment of silence, and I will send around a card. If you'll take just a moment to sign it, we'll get it to her family. Thank you. Thank you, Martha.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank.
You bet.
Proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices. Communications are on the desks. Our first order of business today is that it's our pleasure to have a poet laureate for the county, and my pleasure tonight to appoint for his second year, Jay Leeming, to be our poet laureate for Tompkins County. And Jay has something to share with us. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you. It's an honor to be appointed for another year and to be in this role. I've got two poems for you. The first one I'll read twice because it's quite short. It's about Fall Creek. It's called River. The river leaves this valley over and over. It has been leaving it for thousands of years. A little trickling among the rocks, a leaf swept away, a branch slipped past a few stones. And perhaps I, too, am made only of departure, keys in my pocket, and a name written in sand. We stay by going. The river abandons every place that it visits, and so remains there. I'll do that again. They go by quick sometimes. River. The river leaves this valley over and over. It has been leaving it for thousands of years. A little trickling among the rocks, a leaf swept away, a branch slipped past a few stones. And perhaps I, too, am made only of departure, keys in my pocket and a name written in sand. We stay by going. The river abandons every place that it visits and so remains there. A lot of rivers around here, so you gotta, if you're a poet for the county, you gotta write one sooner or later about a river. This is one more for you. It's called Around the Fire. One night I found myself at the blazing fire of big questions, a fire burning in a rusty oil drum at the edge of town. A few others were there too, warming their hands over the flames. Why am I here? Was burning well. Is there a God? Was going strong. Around us were fields of blue cold, some distant buildings flickering with shadow. Now and then someone threw another question in there, and we watched as it crackled and began to burn. No one said anything. Nothing was discussed or debated. It was enough simply to stand there, warmed by the fire's heat, as one spark after another flung itself up into the dark and went out. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Jay, and a shout out to Stu Stein, who's who initiated this this program. And hi, Brett. Thanks to Brett Bostrick for helping us to identify the right people to do this. Thank you, Brett. We have public privilege of the floor. And members of the public are invited to speak for 3 minutes, up to 3 minutes. And Kathy will help us if anybody needs a little reminding of that. The first person we have is Faye Gougakis.
My name is Faye Gougakis, and I reside in the city of Ithaca. I want to start out by saying I know all of us are concerned about the gas drilling in our community, and I applaud that because I'm also concerned and involved as well. But there are other issues that need to also be in the forefront. An issue that has been dear to my heart for the last several years is the use of our new technologies, laptops, cell phones, texting while driving, safety issues. These issues are not being addressed on a community level. When I was watching your meeting, I caught the tail end of it 2 weeks ago, and I want to commend you for taking on the issue of using laptops and cell phones and the ethics of it during your meeting. I applaud you. That is very, very important. I know some of you are probably more strongly towards having these regulations than others, but it needs to be done. These technologies are taking over our lives in such a fast pace without looking at them, without saying, well, how are we going to use these appropriately? There's no etiquette. There's no discussion. At the Common Council meeting, there are several council people in the city council, and I have yet to address them. In fact, 2 weeks ago, I was going to go to their meeting and talk about the very issue you were talking about, which I found very interesting, but I didn't go because it was cold. But it's something I will be presenting to them, this issue. And there is a council person, at least one, that I feel has been very abusive with the laptop. You do not know what that person is doing. And they're typing and looking at their laptop almost the whole meeting. And I approached this person about, I think, 2 months ago or over a month ago, and their attitude was, you have to deal with it. This is the way it is, and this is, you know, if you don't like it, it's too bad. And I was stunned, because when I saw your discussion, I was really happy, because you talked about how the community sees you. Well, I'll tell you, when I watch some people on the City Common Council doing exactly what you were talking about, it is horrible. You don't know what that person is doing when their head is glued to that laptop like this and typing for long periods of time. So these discussions need to be had, and I commend you for it. Now, we need to take this issue to a community level. And I've been saying this for a long time. The use of cell phones while driving. The use of texting while driving. The fact that our automobiles now have more tinted windows where you can't see what the person is doing inside. That is a hazard to people who are on bicycles, to people who are walking, even to other drivers. This is something that is not being discussed. When we talk about sustainability, and we do in this community, why aren't we concerned about this issue? Because it is a safety issue. Now, last year I met with the deputy chief in the police department, and I asked him, and I don't know what they've done, But I've asked them for us to have a countywide forum where we have all the police representatives, sheriff, police, from Cornell, from TC3, from Ithaca College. We have legislatures, lawmakers there. Okay, we have this discussion of how tinted are these windows supposed to be, and how many tickets are we writing for cell phones? We need to have this discussion. So I end with saying, please do something about this. Please ask the sheriff. Please ask the police department to have a forum where we can have this discussion. We can have publicity. We can have things in the paper. We need publicity to remind people that this is against the law to do, and it's a safety issue. So thank you very much, and I hope I'm not talking to the wind, and somebody will take action. Thank you.
Thank you, Faye. Are there any other members of the public who'd like to speak? There's nobody signed up, but come up to the mic. Please state your name and where you're from, where you live.
I'm Brett Bossard, a resident of the city of Ithaca, and I serve as the executive director of the Community Arts Partnership. I just wanted to thank the legislature and all of Tompkins County for being such a receptive community and a supportive community when it comes to the arts. Jay is our fourth poet laureate here in Tompkins County, and thank you, Martha, for recognizing the work of Stu Stein and the previous CAP director, Richard Driscoll, were really integral in making this a possibility, and it's great that Tompkins was one of the first counties in New York State to have a county poet laureate, and it's because of that post and much of the work that was done by Stu that has helped CAP sort of springboard into doing more work in support of the literary artists in our community. And because of both the work of previous poet laureate Paul Hamill, we've been able to fund programming for workshops with seniors in the community for writing. Paul led those. And just in the last 2 years, the New York State Council on the Arts Office of Literature has supported CAP in engaging in a literary needs survey for writers in our community and surrounding counties. A upcoming publication of writers in the Finger Lakes region, published authors in the Finger Lakes region, and I'm happy to say that Jay will be one of the participants in an inaugural literary festival that will be happening this May, May 7th through the 9th, and it will include a reading by all four of our county poets laureate, which are Catherine Haddon Khan, Michelle Courtney Berry, Paul Hamill, and Jay Leeming. So I invite the legislature to come take part. There will be more information as we nail down all the details of the events. But it's very exciting to be in Tompkins County at this time, that despite any financial difficulties that we may have, we as a community are always and frequently supportive of the artists in our community. So I thank you for that.
Thank you, Brett. Carlos?
Good evening. My name is Carlos Gutierrez. I'm a member of the Latino Civic Association. But today, in addition to that, I'm coming on behalf of the Tompkins County Immigrant Rights Coalition, which is an organization made up of several community organizations that are interested in the immigration issue. The Tompkins County Immigrant Rights Coalition has joined a national campaign called Immigrant Reform for America, Immigration Reform for America. And particularly in New York State, we are organizing a campaign basically to pass a comprehensive immigration reform that includes basically stopping the massive detentions of immigrants that is happening at this very moment, and give a citizenship passage to possibility to immigrants, resolve the problem that undocumented workers have at this time, create a more humane environment for immigrants, and unify their families who have been separated all this time, that have been detention and deportations. In the last year, approximately 400,000 people were detained, of which 375,000 were deported. And there were approximately 3,000 children who are American citizens whose parents have been deported, and who basically they are here in the United States without their parents. So, I'm here to invite you to an event this coming Thursday at the Women Community Building, 6:30. There's a caravan going on at this very moment, visiting several cities and towns in New York State, visiting the offices of congressmen, basically letting them know that the community wants immigration reform now. And it's going to start in Ithaca on Thursday, 6:30 p.m. We're going to have a reception, and we would like to invite you all, no matter where, what side of the aisle you are. This is, you know, this is an American problem, and you know, we are all included. We are working very closely with groups in giving message to Senator Schumer, because Senator Schumer is the person who is going to introduce the next immigration reform bill to the Senate. So it's very important that Senator Schumer not only gets our concerns and ideas about how to reform this failed immigration policy, but also to get our support. And the support is reach out to other people that should come in order to do this. So hopefully we will see you there, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak?
Could we say the time and place?
Carlos, could you say the time? You said
women.
Women
Community Building at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, the 18th of February.
2 days from now, 6:30 at the Women's Community Building.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Legislator privilege of the floor. And we're going to start with Pat Pryor. Busy month for you, Pat. It's a busy month for you.
Yes, it has been, that's for sure. It's my pleasure tonight to present the Tompkins County Distinguished Youth Award to Chelsea Weidman. She's here tonight with her mom. If you two would come forward, please. Chelsea is a student at the Lansing Central School. For the third year in a row since she moved to Lansing, Chelsea has held a charity birthday party which benefits the Lansing Food Pantry. Each year she has collected monetary and food donations at her party instead of gifts for herself. For the third time, she has donated over $500 in monetary donations and hundreds of food items as well. Chelsea is also a regular volunteer at the food pantry, assisting in setting up the tables and food necessary to serve many families in the area. Previous to living in Lansing, Chelsea held several similar birthday parties in New Jersey, benefiting St. Jude's Children's Hospital, Deborah Hart and Lung Hospital, and Alex's Lemonade Stand. In total, she has donated several thousands of dollars and other items to benefit other children while celebrating her life. Chelsea's generous nature extends beyond a yearly party to school, where she is a member of a group called Creating a Safe School, mentoring fifth graders on bullying. She's a part of the student council, part of the Bettering the School Environment and Servicing Others group. She participates in the Lansing High musical shows each year, dances ballet, jazz, and lyrical classes, all while maintaining a 95-plus average in advanced courses. Wow. She is also an active member of her church youth group and regularly participates in events servicing others. Chelsea is a very well-rounded person who sets the bar high for herself in many ways and has continually met those high expectations in her achievements both in school and in life. She's a pleasure to know and be with and truly exemplifies the distinguished youth of Tompkins County. Thank you, Chelsea. Congratulations. This is the plaque that we have for Chelsea, and I'd like to read it. Tompkins County Distinguished Youth Award presented to Chelsea Weidman in recognition of your outstanding commitment to your community, February 2010. Sponsored by Bangs Ambulance Service, the Tompkins County Legislature, Cougar Radio Group, Purity Ice Cream, and A&B Awards and Engraving. Congratulations. Would you like to say something? Okay.
I just want to say thank you so much for this award. It is an honor. I would like to thank Nancy Myers for nominating me and my mom for everything she does. My mom always taught me to give back to your community in any way that you can, and this is how I love to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Chelsea. Other legislators, Kathy?
Oh, thank you. Yes. Hi, everybody. I just wanted to chime in along with Carlos and encourage everybody to come to the Women's Community Building on Thursday, the 18th. And I love the way you expressed it. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you might be on this side, on this issue. The fact is, it's a really complex issue. Immigration reform is something that concerns everyone in this country. It affects everyone, and it's really great to have a community dialogue and a celebration of the efforts of these individuals to bring it to the attention of our legislators. And besides that, the food and the company is going to be fantastic. I'll be there, and I hope to see a lot of my colleagues and community members there too. Thank you.
Anyone else? Frank and Carol. Frank.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to put my Water Resources Council Chairman's hat on for just a moment. In case you haven't caught up to an issue of the Ithaca Journal from last week, February the 11th, those of us that have been very concerned about the Marcellus gas drilling and some of the issues surrounding it, there was an article in the paper entitled EPA Launches Watchdog Program. And this is something for Carol, because she's our designated follower of this kind of information. The EPA wants to make sure that any citizen that, let me read you this, witnesses any suspicious activity related to location, time and date of problems, materials, equipment, and vehicles involved, observable environmental impacts, according to the press release that they issued. There have been some concerns about trucks dropping liquid, certainly out in Caroline, that some of us were made aware of it about a year ago that that was happening, and we backtracked it to Pennsylvania, believe it or not. But they've given a phone number, and it can be anonymous. If anybody witnesses anything, this would be a good opportunity to get it out into the public so that we can all keep an eye on things. Would you like me to? The number is 877-919-4372. Let me say that again. 877-919-4372. And there is a website here, but it's too long to repeat. We'll be here all night. I'll give this to Carol so that you can circulate it any way that you think is fit. We'll be talking about this at the Water Resources Council meeting on Monday. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Carol? Yes, this doesn't let you off the hook, though, so thank you for watching for this, and hopefully we will not see violations to report yet. In that regard, in the regard of gas drilling, I want to let you all know about two discussions that I attended on our behalf that were called by Don Barber and other folks from TCOG, pursuing what are the some of the ways in which we can have any local jurisdiction over gas drilling or its
concomitant things that it will bring. And one of them had to do with legal articles that have been written recently about considerations on under local home rule powers of zoning and site review, that there is some precedent in New York State case law that we might be able to pursue to impact things like noise, the look of these sites, the setback, the distance from the neighbors. And as we learn more about that, I will keep you informed. And the other one was a discussion that followed about the ways in which Sullivan County, as a county and eight of its towns, have been laying the groundwork with an outfit called Delta Engineers, and the same law firm that's been writing about these land use controls related to road use agreements. So again, as there is more to report on that, and as we, on that one, I think we will involve staff. And then I just wanted to convey an invitation that we have all gotten to come and hear the mayor of Dish, Texas, has been moved enough by the things that happened in his town related to this kind of slick water drilling of the Barnett Shale and the air pollution that they did not expect, that he is doing a speaking tour. And he will be on Saturday, February 20th, Frank, if you like to go. Maybe we can drive down there together. 9:30 to 11:30 in the morning, he will be giving a talk about his experiences and the air quality studies that found high levels of carcinogens and neurotoxins in the air. That's 9:30 to 11 a.m. in Elmira Heights at the Heights Theater. And we've all been invited as well, any municipal officials, and other people who go down to a breakfast before that at 8:30. If you can't make it on the 20th, his speaking tour involves Oneonta. Well, he's only Oneonta tonight. So any of you listening from Oneonta, 7 to 9 tonight, Downsville Wednesday the 17th, Binghamton on the 18th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the East Middle School, Dimmock, Pennsylvania, on Friday, February 19th, the Elk Lake School Auditorium, and Calicoon on the 20th. If people would like the details on that, I can let you know.
Thank you, Cal. Will?
Thank you, Martha. Last Saturday, I participated in a picket rally that was taking place in one of our local businesses, actually a business that's owned by an outside company but operates locally. You've probably read about it in the newspaper. It was a hair-cutting business that had fired an employee for her failure to comply with a new rule that required all hair cutters to also sell products that amounted to about 15% of their wage, which in this case was $8 an hour. She was fired, and she'd been was much beloved by her clientele, but was merely shown the door. And so happens this woman, a single mom, getting by with help of Section 8 and WIC, Medicaid, but was keeping it together until she was fired. And fortunately, we have in our community the Toppings County Workers Center, which became aware of this and put out a call. At least 50 people showed up on a very, very cold, windy day and stood out to raise community awareness. I was very, very happy to see one of our my good colleagues, Kathy Luz Herrera, there, who not only marched and held a sign, but made a very, very good little speech talking about why this should matter to us all. And certainly on the legislature, we should be concerned, because when workers are poorly treated, we as a community end up bearing the costs. And I think it's to all of our benefit to pay attention to this case in particular, but the more general situation of workers need to have jobs that are not only jobs, but jobs that pay reasonably and working conditions that are a testament to this community. So I thank you for the time, and I encourage, if you are interested in knowing more, contacting the Tompkins County Workers Center.
Thank you, Will. Pam, and then Leslie.
Yes, I guess I'd just like to say a couple of words about the NYSIC conference that four of us went to last week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, the New York State Association of Counties. And it was a very interesting, it always is interesting to get together with other municipal leaders and talk about mutual problems and solutions. I will say we were well represented. Martha made this suggestion to the conference that we have one of the workshops be on the Marcellus Shale, which was a very well attended and very lively workshop. Ed Marks was one of the speakers, and he did an excellent job. And then later in the day, there was sort of an open forum, and that was the largest, I think, group outside of the cocktail parties and was attended. And it was really interesting to see, because what we had there, we had people, we actually had some representatives from the Landowners Association, and this is a group of landowners who have leased their property out and have formed a coalition and are promoting the gas drilling. And I'm not sure how they got to this meeting, because it was supposed to be a meeting of municipal officials. But mostly what you had, and of course then you had us who are very, you know, we've looked at this issue a lot and are not particularly shy about telling people what we think. But the vast majority of people there were very just, I think, troubled by this and needed information. And so I really felt as if what we had done, and what in particular what Martha had done, gave them the opportunity to hear both sides of the issue. And that is in everybody's interest for that to happen. So that was one of the more gratifying things of the conference. The one major disappointment, and I keep telling people this because I just find it very troubling, is that at these conferences, generally you get our leadership in Albany come and speak. For example, Sheldon Silver was slated to speak at a breakfast, and the governor was slated to speak at a lunch, and there were several others. And frankly, the only one who showed up was our lieutenant governor, and I just found that found that disturbing. And I know it's difficult times, and I know it's hard to stand up before a group of people who are struggling with hanging on to programs and people that they value in their workplace. But frankly, that is part of our job, and that's part of our job on the county level, and it's part of the job of our elected representatives in Albany, and I really was very disappointed by their lack of showing up at this meeting. This was a statewide. These are their first line defense out there, or theoretically their supporters out in the community, and they were not there when we needed them to be there, and I for one was very disappointed in that.
Thank you, Pam. Leslie and then Mike.
I want to thank Kathy and Will for being out for the rally on Saturday, and for some of us who could not be there, we made sure that we sent on letters to the management of Crosscutters letting them know that we do not appreciate that behavior. But it brings to mind that that's just one of the many, many issues that employees face in our county, and I'm hoping that people will be brave enough to bring some of it to the forefront. For many of them, they don't, because it is their only means of a survival or getting along, of making an income, and so they don't say anything about these things and just suck it up and keep going. But I surely encourage people to keep speaking out when they feel like they are being wronged by their employers. I also want to say thanks to those of you who were able to come to the strategic plan input session of the Downtown Ithaca Alliance. It was really worth getting the input of the community and others to make some changes to that plan, as well as for good and some that would be better for our community. At our last meeting, I mentioned the quote and said, because I didn't want to make information up, although I could tell you some of it, I wanted to come back. I did my homework to share with you what the people who are represented on that quilt hanging here in honor of Black History Month, what they did. Most of you know of the national names like Sojourner Truth, who was very instrumental in the anti-slavery movement as well as the suffragette movement. Harriet Tubman, who we all know as the conductor, the main conductor of the Underground Railroad, leading more than 300 slaves to freedom up north, escaping the freedom up north, a very strong woman. But Jermaine Wesley Logan, if you still have your little note cards, was born into slavery. He ran away, escaped slavery, and came up north. He spent a lot of time, he ran to Canada, spent a lot of time in Canada, then moved to Rochester. His connection to Ithaca is he was here for 2 years and was an AME Zion minister, but also became a station master on the Syracuse portion of the Underground Railroad and was one of the people who was charged with the Jerry rescue, with Jerry Henry's escape. And the Jerry rescue monument stands in Syracuse. So that's Mr. Logan. Mr. Crum, George Crum, who was known as, born as George Speck, his parents were African-American. He had an African-American father and a Native American mother, and he is the inventor of the potato chip. If you know the story, he is from Saratoga, that's where he was, and clients in the restaurant where he became a chef, as he found his calling in cooking, decided they didn't like the French fries that were being served. They were too thick, and so he decided, I'm just going to go all the way to the opposite end since they're being so rude and make them so thin you can poke it with a fork. However, it backfired, and people really like the chips. So he is responsible for the invention of the potato chip. His great-grandmother was born into slavery as well. And this is my favorite, is Mabel. Mabel Wynn Van Dyke was in Caroline. Frank, did you know that?
Yep, and so were the Bale. Go ahead.
She was fondly known as Grandma Van Dyke. Sunday school teacher, music teacher, practical nurse. You know, the nurses who went around did all the midwifery work. That was her a lot. One of the quotes that I was able to find in the Caroline history was written in the Ithaca Journal in 1949 about her when she was leaving after 40 years of living in Tompkins County. She was moving to Rochester. The quote from the Ithaca Journal said, "Laughter, wisdom, and service for over a half century have been the gifts of Mrs. Mabel Webb Van Dyke to the Caroline community, which she left this weekend for a new home in Rochester." She lived there for a long time. Sometimes a person fills a place in the community so quietly that we grow unaware of how much their influence means. Mrs. Van Dyke is like that. And that was from a storekeeper in Caroline. So Grandma Van Dyke lived and took care of everybody's children, helped bring a lot of them into the world, and was really well known. I see she lived in Caroline for over 70 years, I think, not 40, over 70 years. So that's my homework. I hope that if you didn't know about them, now you've learned a little something more about them. Were you going to add something, Frank?
Yeah, could I add something to that?
Lesson, thanks. That's nice of you to do that. The family lived on Level Green Road.
Level Green Road.
And there's still a historic marker there that we take care of. The house is standing. It's way, way off the road. And there's information in the Caroline History Room, if you have any time to stop out. The Baylors were also and continue to be very associated. And they had a very close association with Cornell University.
Very much so.
As a matter of fact, as far as the first graduate that we were able to find. Thanks for doing that, Lesson.
You're most welcome. We continue to celebrate Black History Month, and I encourage you, there are lots of activities happening in Tompkins County, and I encourage you to attend as many as you can. So thank you.
Thank you, Lesley. Mike.
As a local history buff, I could sit here all night listening to wonderful stories like that of the great people of Tompkins County. But Pam, what you said brought up something that I wanted to talk about today, and that is it looks like we're back at the state legislature to dysfunction with a capital D. And I think it bodes ill for the legislative process this year, and particularly a budget in a horrible recession year like we're dealing with right now. The New York State Senate, the majority's been tipping back and forth, just expelled one of its members, to which I think it's a good thing that they did that, because he was convicted of slashing a woman. But he's, of course, going to appeal that as to whether he can actually be expelled from the Senate. I expect the courts will uphold the Senate for doing that. But meanwhile, we've seen the majority go back and forth. Now they're going to have a special election in New York City to fill that seat March 16th to see whether that in that heavily Democratic area, a Democrat is elected. That's what they expect will happen, but that's what they thought would happen in the United States Senate seat in Boston. So it's the voters who make those kind of decisions. This last week, there was an article, an opinion article in the Ithaca Journal that talked about the need for a constitutional convention. And I would like to put my name behind that as well. We need to begin talking about that. We don't have a chance to vote on whether or not there will be one until 2017, unless and until the legislature decides to put that proposition to us sooner. And I think we should be talking to our state representatives, both from the Senate and the Assembly, and saying to them, we want an opportunity to vote for a constitutional convention sooner. In my view, if it was on the ballot this year, it would probably pass with pretty easily. But if it goes to 2017, who knows? In 1997, the chance and the opportunity was squandered, and look where we are. We also need to change the way we redistrict our state legislative districts, stop this heavy partisanship and to divide the state up so that there's just more and more gridlock. We have to get behind this. We have to get good government groups out there, including the League of Women Voters, who over the years has opposed the constitutional conventions based on the one that failed in 1967. I think I'd like to see them take another look at that and get behind a constitutional convention. There'll be discussions about this in Tompkins County coming up soon, and I hope folks think about this and talk to our elected representatives at the state level, who, of course, don't want to discuss it.
Thank you, Mike. Agreed. Anything else? Brian?
No one else brought it up, so David Squires, congratulations on the Super Bowl. I do want to recognize one of our colleagues here, and I happen to be in attendance for a little bit. Saturday morning, Pat Pryor took it upon herself to have a forum at the town of Lansing for the AES pilot issue. It's an issue for all of us, but it's particular of importance to Lansing, and I do represent a small piece of the town of Lansing. And it was very nice, very informative. She did bring in the heavy hitters. Joe was there, Martha, Will, Jay Franklin. And it really caught me as something maybe we should all be doing at various points, especially when there's some issues of particular importance in our own communities. And I know that was, and I just wanted to commend you on it. I thought that was very nicely done and very well attended, and hopefully they got a lot of information that they wanted to get out of it.
Thank you very much, Brian. Anyone else? Very good. Well, we are lucky today to have a Youth Services Department bringing us a special topic, and I think we're starting with Nancy Zahler.
Thank you. I'm Nancy Zahler. I'm director of the Tompkins County Youth Services Department and proud to be so. Our department is responsible for assuring that about 8,000 young people a year get services from agencies and municipalities that help them develop the skills they need to succeed in school, work, and life. Our continuum of prevention and intervention programs also helps youth from 0 to 20 avoid delinquency and other risky behaviors that would increase the likelihood of needing more intensive and expensive services. Last month, we were here promoting the value of mentors and recognizing two of the programs we fund that help connect young people with positive adults. Tonight, we're here to update the legislature and the public on our working relationship and partnership with the Community Coalition for Healthy Youth, which is dedicated to preventing and reducing substance use and abuse among young people. In October, our department helped secure a five-year, $650,000 grant to help reduce youth access and use of alcohol, pharmaceuticals, marijuana, and tobacco. Tonight, I'm going to hand over the program to Chris Bennett, our planner, Janice Johnson, our coordinator of community youth services. They work as staff from our department with the Community Coalition for Healthy Youth on this important project and issue. They're going to share some findings from our first countywide youth survey and some of the ways in which we are working in collaboration with the coalition, our municipalities, and our school districts to make a difference in the lives of young people on these issues. So they do a great job. I'm sure you'll enjoy the presentation.
Hi, thank you. I'm Chris Bennett, and I'm conscious of the time. We supposedly have 15 minutes. We've used about a minute and a half with Nancy, so I will try to go fast, but I will tell you that usually when we do these presentations, we take an hour to an hour and a quarter, so if you are left wanting more, we have some opportunities for you out in the community that are taking place in March with more information. A little bit of information about the survey. It was given across New York State in late 2008 in our county. Dryden, Groton, Ithaca, Lansing, and Trumansburg school districts participated, a total of 4,919 students. Newfield had the option to participate but chose not to. We're hoping they will when the survey is repeated later this year. Since our coalition is about reducing youth substance use, that's what we're going to focus on today with our presentation. You should each have a remote control device that we left on the table in front of you. And rather than just having me tell you what the information is, I want you to guess what the information is. These devices work like the things they use on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire when they poll the audience. So your answers will show up on the screen, and then I'll reveal the right answer. I'm Meredith Vieira tonight.
Is this paying attention to have this?
It's, and if when you put in what you think is the right answer, you change your mind and you want to override it, just go ahead and do that. It'll override your previous answer. So the first question is, how many local high schoolers grades 9 through 12 do you think are current alcohol users. By current, I mean within the last 30 days, and by alcohol, I mean a whole drink of alcohol, not a sip at their sister's wedding or taking communion or celebrating Passover. And we've given out some response devices to others in the room, too. So, okay.
Can you just click once? Is that?
You can only click once. So here's what you said. It seems like most of you think it's 49%. In fact, it's only 1 in 3, 32%. If we look by grade, this chart and all the charts I'm going to show you compare our Tompkins County results with state results. Those are the light green results. And national results, those are the dark green results. We only have national results for grades 8, 10, and 12, but it gives us a basis of comparison. And for alcohol, we see that the use isn't as, our use locally is comparable more or less with what the state rates are. I do want to point out the jump between 9th grade and 10th grade. It seems that that's when the risk increases for our local students. Now let's look at marijuana. 10% from our survey of ninth graders use marijuana regularly. That's within the past 30 days. What do you think the rate is for 12th graders? All right. So the right answer is, in fact, 21%, 1 in 5. This chart, again, shows the state and national comparisons. Our local marijuana use is higher than state and national rates, except for grade 12. But, again, I want to point out the where it jumps. Look at the jump between grade 8 and 9 where it doubles, and then between grade 9 and 10 when it almost doubles again. Those are ages of risk for young people. Let's move on to cigarettes. What grade do you think has the highest rate of current cigarette users? All right. You're pretty evenly split then between 10th, 11th, 12th. In fact, it's 11th grade. Sort of wasn't what I was expecting. I would have thought it got higher. Locally, our cigarette use rates are much lower than national and state rates. Good news, Tompkins County. Let's move on to smokeless tobacco. Do you think that 12th grade rates are higher or lower than state and national peers? You're wrong. It's higher. They exceed state rates for every grade, and they exceed national rates for 12th grade. We do see that our use rates are higher in the rural school districts than they are in the city school district. Pharmaceutical abuse is a growing trend both nationally and locally. And while this doesn't represent a lot of kids, these are dangerous substances, and they're often used with alcohol or other things. This is non-medical use, so this is something that was not prescribed to you or that you're taking for non-medical reasons. Which substance do you think Tompkins County young people are likely to start using at the youngest age? Well, you're split. It is cigarettes. 12 and a half years old is when those kids who've smoked use their first cigarette. Alcohol, they wait till they're almost 13. Marijuana, when they're almost 14. Our local kids who used alcohol are most likely to get it from a friend or from a family member, parents or siblings. Most of the work that we're doing in communities is therefore targeted at family and caregivers, as opposed to buying with a fake ID. Only 1% of our students got their alcohol in that way. The 21% of other could be like a dorm party or whatever else. And we also know that most young people who drink in private homes. So again, that's another reason to target families and parents for our work. There was a lot of other information in the survey, but I thought you might be interested in some information about computers. So how many high schoolers do you think have a Facebook or MySpace or some sort of social networking account? This is as of a year ago.
Jim, can you explain what that is?
So you're right here. And I would venture to guess that since this was a year ago, that the rates might even be higher. Most young people have access to a computer at home as well as internet access at home. We were glad to see that because we know that this can be a real indicator of success being connected to resources. We also know that another thing that helps young people is being connected to activities. So it's good to see that most young people are connected either through a school-based or community-based activity or through a sports team. And I'm going to share in a minute about those who participate a lot and what value they get from that. So one message we have is that parents make a big difference. What this chart shows is that kids who said their parents would disapprove of their using substances were much less likely to use those substances than kids who said their parents would not care. So only 17% of the kids who said my parents would disapprove had used alcohol within the past 30 days, whereas 61% who said my parents wouldn't care had used alcohol within the past 30 days. So if we're talking about binge drinking, which of these four strategies do you think reduces the likelihood that kids binge drink the most? Okay, so you're pretty, you think having family rules. In fact, it's keeping track of your kids, knowing where they are and who they're with, makes the biggest difference. It reduces binge drinking by two-thirds. It makes a big difference in 30-day use of other substances as well. I also want to share with you the impact of youth being able to participate in community-based activities. Youth who participate 10 or more times, that would be monthly involvement, and these are some of the programs that our department funds as well as are available in other ways through their communities. Kids who participate are much more likely to do well in school. They like school more. They get better grades than kids who don't participate. They're also likely to wait to use substances until they're older. They wait a full year before they have their first cigarette, almost a full year for marijuana and half a year for alcohol. So just being involved in activity reduces the age of onset for these substances. These young people also have lower rates of depressive symptoms. Kids who said, I think I'm a failure most days, I'm sad most of the time, or life just isn't worth it. So we may not think that we're helping in all these ways just by offering programs, but we are. So what I want to leave you with is that most young people are not using alcohol or other drugs, but there are some who do use these substances. Local marijuana and smokeless tobacco rates are higher than state rates. We should be concerned. Pharmaceutical use is an emerging trend here in Tompkins County and across the nation. And parents and programs make a difference in reducing youth risk behaviors, including substance use. I'm going to pass the microphone to Janice, who's going to talk about the last couple of points.
So now that we have the data, we've been sharing it with the local communities. It's been rolled out in Groton and in Trumansburg through community forums. And it will be in Dryden and in Lansing. They will soon get presentations. We're working with a collaboration of different people in all of the communities because we know to reach the entire population and to have a community change that's really going to make a difference in young people's lives, that we have to work in collaboration. So we're working with schools, police departments, town and village officials and departments, and our local youth commissions that played a big part in helping us get this grant and a big part in connecting us with their communities. Creating safe home directories, Groton and Trumansburg are considering and beginning to work on this. Establishing drug-free school zones around schools. Not all schools in Tompkins County have that. Restricting availability of drug paraphernalia and head shops is something that Groton is concerned with, and they're going to take a look at. Asking merchants to proof the group for purchases of alcohol and trying to get merchants to play a part in this. Lansing is doing a real interesting rollout of the data. They are going to invite 50 young people in their school who they consider as leaders, and they're going to share the data with their high schoolers and then bring them together in the summer and give them some resources so that they can decide what changes they need to make in Lansing to help young people with drug and alcohol and tobacco. They're also going to do a presentation to the faculty and staff, and they mean everybody from bus drivers to cafeteria people, because they know all the people in the school connect with the kids, not just the teachers. And then they're going to roll it out also to parents and community members. But we are doing a lot of work in communities. Groton and Trumansburg and Dryden are the first three we're connecting with, but Lansing. Once the communities see the data, they get really emotionally connected to this and want to make a change. And so it's been fun. We have about 15 action steps that communities are considering working on, and we're working very closely with them. If you want to know what your community is up to, we'll be happy to let you know that.
Thank you, Janice and Chris. I trust that if anybody has a community group, church or other community center group that might be interested in this presentation, I'm going to take a wild guess and say you'd probably be interested in making a trip there. I have one question before I put to others. The last point that you made, Chris, about the frequent users of programs, I guess I would say I wonder if there's really, do you have a sense that going to these programs caused young people not to have depressive symptoms and they have better grades, or is it sort of a correlation? In other words, are kids who have the characteristics by which they did get better grades and not be depressed also tend to do a lot of activities after school? Is that, in other words, cause and effect is a
tricky. Well, it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. It's a little hard for us to know. All we know is that young people who are engaged have better outcomes. And a lot of the programs that we support with our funding, the program managers from Cooperative Extension, for example, reach out to young people who aren't involved already in school sports or in a school club or on a Boy Scout troop or whatever. So we just know being connected with positive adults and making positive use of your time makes a difference. Okay. So it's hard to say which is the chicken and which is the egg.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Peter?
What gives you confidence that the answers that you get to these questions are in fact correct?
Thanks for asking that question. That's something I usually talk about when I'm doing a longer presentation. There's a number of things that give us confidence in these data. The first is that this is a national organization that does the survey. I call it clean the data. There are different questions used to screen out mischievous answers. So, for example, if a young person answers one question that they use alcohol within the last in their lifetime, but they have not used it within the last 30 days, that's an inconsistency and would flag that response. They're asked at the end of the survey, how honest were you on this survey? If they say, not at all honest, okay, that survey's quarantined. But probably the most important thing that can happen is that if the students understand why they're being asked this information, that they're assured that it's anonymous, there's nothing on here that would flag them as giving an answer that might be rather personal and have somebody know that they did that. Teachers are asked to not be walking around the room peeking at surveys while students are responding so that they feel confident in their anonymity and the confidentiality of it. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions? Janice and Chris, thank you very much. And Nancy, this is very informative.
So we've passed around a summary of highlights from the survey, and we also left copies of our OJ guide for each of you and information about the Drug Collection Day event that's happening on March 6th that our group is connected with. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Love that technology. That was fun.
And send that's the clickers great. Back. They're not going to do you any good.
These clickers are a very engaging tool, and they are available for lending, or we make the entrepreneurial charges more.
Great. Thank you very much. Looking at the audience, I would like to reorder things a little bit. I'm pretty sure Dan from Lansing Star Online isn't here for the full agenda we have tonight. I'm not sure about everybody else in the audience. But I, with Pam's agreement, I would love to ask you to bring up Resolution D, please, at this time.
Resolution D? Okay. Resolution D, supporting revised agreement between AES CUGA and the Tompkins County Industrial Development Agency. It's the revised one in your red folder, and it's, I so move.
Is there a second? Seconded by Mike. Kathy.
Thank you. I noticed in our red folder that there's a document that we got from another municipality. Let's see. That would be Lansing. Where is that? Saying that they passed a resolution in support. Where was that, y'all?
It's on your correspondence sheet.
Thank you. And I just wanted to say that that was very helpful to me. And also, having listened to the discussions that have occurred before about the real possibility that we would be way overcharged and would have lots of legal fees and would be in limbo for a long time in this tough economic time, makes even the scary prospect of these numbers seem like a better alternative than what we could have if we don't support this resolution, and that's why I'm supporting it.
And if I might add, I think this is, you've got D confused with B. There's B is revised.
Okay.
But there shouldn't be a revised AES resolution.
Well, it says
the title.
Okay. I'm sorry. You're right.
Is that right?
It isn't.
Okay.
It's not revised. That was the whole point of doing it the way we did, was that so it wouldn't be revised.
I think
so,
on that
yes,
first.
It's the unrevised version of our of that.
Is everybody clear? Resolution. Okay. Frank.
I think all that refers to is that the agreement is revised. Can you say something about the IDA hearing today?
I was not at the IDA hearing today, so I was somebody who was on the IDA would be.
I was there, and Will was there, and Michael Stamm and Dan Kogan, Joe was there, Jay Franklin was there. Let's see, the transcript will be available, I think, as of Friday, and.
How about a general sense of what?
Gene McPheeter spoke in favor. The superintendent of the Lansing Schools was there, Steve Grimm, and he read a statement that was opposing the revision. I think we got that. Did we all get that one in the email? I'm not sure. There were a number of questions. Kathy Miller from the town board had a number of concerns, and even though the town board did unanimously pass a supportive resolution, she has expressed to me that she would like to be much more involved in the future. But so she spoke. Mr. Dittman from the school board,
David Dittman,
was opposed. And to try to reconstruct people's arguments is difficult. But if Pat, you can I'm sorry, Pat was there, of course. So, if anybody, if you want to, any of you want to weigh in, go ahead. Will?
Can we get a sense of what some of the comments were like, Mark?
I think the most substantive comments in opposition was from Mr. Cole, who is an assessor and or appraiser, I guess, actually. But he questions our model, the model which we used, and provided data comparing this plant and the conclusion with the figures that had arisen at of Somerset, another coal plant that has a much more much higher valuation. I have yet to sit down and actually study his figures, but I certainly plan to do that.
Mm-hmm. And I got a message from Jay Franklin today. Mr. Coles talked about discounted cash flow analysis, and basically he was proposing a different way of
evaluating
this. And Jay has written me back and said, "Well, no, you really can't do that." So without going through the whole thing, and this is—it's important. There are a lot of ideas out there, and those have come out in the public discussion. And some of those are important for us to carry forward for the next negotiation. And others, we already know that well, it doesn't work. But Pat, do you want to?
One of the comments that Mr. Dittman made had to do with, given that there's been such a dramatic change, but that it appears to be temporary because of the economic situation, why not just keep the valuation the way it is for a couple of years and then come back and look at it again? I actually responded to that and explained to him about the assessments having to be at 100% value. It's not something that the state allows us to do, so... That was one of his comments.
Joe, did you want to add anything?
No, I think you've captured the most. As I understand the superintendent's argument, it's not so much that he's against the pilot, but he's concerned about the steps that pilot takes down from its current value to the ultimate $100 million. It does drop from $160 million to $130 million in the first year, and then is reduced by $10 million in each of the next 3 years to get to 100. I think he'd prefer a more smoothed phase down of those values. But I think everything else has been pretty well captured here.
Carol?
Yeah, I voted against this in committee. Maybe it's twice now as this has come forward. And I am going to vote against it here as well. I just don't feel comfortable with it. I understand why people feel like this is the best we can do right now. And I do thank the negotiators, because I think that it is a very difficult negotiation. I think a lot of effort went into the whole process of thinking through how to go about this. And I think there was a lot of good faith on both, you know, our part and the AES Cayuga folks. I just still believe, after looking at it, and I spent, believe me, a lot of time looking at it, that 4 years is just too long for us, and realize that we are not voting on doing this. We're voting on a recommendation to the IDA about how they should proceed. I just am not comfortable recommending 4 years. I might have been able to vote for just this year or the second year. I just think for 4 years that we want to do not just due diligence, but extra diligence for the amount of revenue that's going to be lost. We're sharing too much of the pain without coming back or asking the negotiators to go back and figure out a way to do something of a reach back. This is a pilot. It's not a tax. It's an in lieu of tax. So whether there are any models that we could spend more time looking at models for next year, the year after, as to ways in which if we share the pain, they may be able to reach back. Should there ever be gain, and there may not be for coal anymore, in which case that wouldn't be an issue, or. going ahead and saying, yes, we'll go ahead and do this for this year, but to go beyond 1 year, that we would hire an energy consultant who would address some of these questions as to how you address the formulas. We have great talent, and we used it in the assessment department and experience, Steve Witcher, but I don't think we have as much experience to be able to go and negotiate with those from the industry who make a living and who have teams of lawyers behind them, both locally and from their national, giving them information about how you do these formulas. So just from a negotiating standpoint, I just don't believe that we should be sending, that all three bodies should be sending a unanimous message that, yes, this is easy, yes, this is good. So I will be a holdout. I will also just raise the issue that I represent a district, a large entity that's a nonprofit, that we ask to make payments in lieu of taxes. In this case, without even owing, being exempted from taxes, and I just think we need to do beyond due diligence if we're going to make these kinds of concessions. So I just can't support it.
I'm going to jump in because I thought we weren't quite finished with about the hearing, but I've got Frank, then Mike, then Jim, then Julie after my turn. A couple of things. First, we don't ask, and the IDA doesn't ask Cornell if there are no payments in lieu of taxes. The city has an arrangement, but we don't. We have 4 years worth of numbers here, but we have already agreed. Part of the agreement, part of the revised agreement, is that we will reopen negotiations in May or June this year. So there is, The subsequent numbers past 130 million are going to be renegotiated. So this idea of 4 years, it's not 4 years. And I will tell you that Jay Franklin pointed out something to me, and then raised this at the meeting on Saturday. By the way, today's hearing was not a debate. There wasn't really give and take. It was, with the exception of a couple of factual points, there were simply just people speaking to the IDA, so it wasn't really a discussion. But I will say that Jay Franklin pointed out that if the revised agreement fails to pass the IDA, and the meeting is next Wednesday, February 24th at 3:30 in the old jail, if it fails to pass the IDA, then by March 1st, he has to decide on a value of the plant. He has to, from what every piece of information he can conjure up and find, he has to put something down and has to be able to justify it to a State Office of Real Property Services. They look very carefully at power plant valuations, so they will be looking at why he chooses whatever the number is that he chooses. And if they're not satisfied, then, as Pat said, we have their consequences. We lose our $140,000 in state aid. But I will tell you that just as a sort of ballpark number, it's clear there's justification for a value of $100 million. That means that as of March 1st, he would say that that's the value, so that the school district in October would be only getting taxes on the basis of $100 million, not $130 million. If that were the value that he would choose. So without everything that goes into that negotiation, that negotiated number, I'll tell you that that's something that we were hoping to avoid with the pilot. So in terms of how this is actually the best we can do, I think Jay really enlightened us on that fact. So Mike, no, Frank was next, then Mike, et cetera.
Thanks, Martha. Thanks for reminding everyone that this spring there's supposed to be a discussion anyway. But if memory serves me right, in addition to that, the document already includes a provision for a reopener in the event of an extraordinary event. And I I mean, frankly, that means to me that it can be opened almost at any time if both sides agree that something extraordinary has happened, like perhaps the price of coal has made it more profitable and certainly more economical for them to produce energy in a coal-fired plant. So while I respect what Carol's concern is, frankly, I think the alternative to not doing this could be even more severe to the community. And I think Pat deserves a big thank you for putting that meeting together. And I know Brian has already mentioned that, but I've heard some real positive things that came out of that. It was not a contentious group whatsoever. It was kind of an informational exchange, which you're always happy to participate in. Thanks.
Mike.
Actually, Martha, you and Frank answered my question, which was my understanding that the 4 years was not cast in stone, but there was this reopener possibility and that negotiations were going to be ongoing here. So I really don't need to say more than that.
Thank you. Jim?
That was my comment and question also.
Cool. Okay. Dooley.
I was out of town, or else I would have been at Pat's weekend forum, and I would have tried to go here today. I'm sorry. At least I got back before the meeting was over tonight. The concept that we should have something other than a four-year agreement, I think, would be a mistake, Carol, because it's much kinder to everyone concerned to try to go from point A to point B gradually. That isn't to say that the IDA could not itself, when it votes, consider what Mr. Grimm is talking about, not front-loading the change, but smoothing it in a different way. But I think the model that the county team used makes a lot of sense, and I would be interested to know what that one speaker's problems are with it. I don't know what else he would want to consider as part of the terms that you have to think about when valuing something. Martha, I would like to make a small change in the third whereas for clarity. Is this the right time for me to do that?
Sure.
Okay. The third whereas says, whereas during 2009 several meetings were held at the request of AES. I'd like to add the word Cayuga because AES is a much larger corporation. AES Cayuga is the one that asked us to reopen it.
Is that friendly to Pam and Mike?
That sounds, yes, friendly.
And there's one other piece in that same whereas. It refers to the economic recession. It significantly affected the financial condition of the Lansing facility. I'd like to add, and that in turn would affect its valuation as an income property for tax purposes.
Can you repeat that one, do it?
And that in turn would affect, this is the economic recession, that in turn would affect its valuation as an income property for tax purposes. Because that's the valuation that we're using.
Is that friendly?
I think so, but I'd like to hear it one more time if I could.
Okay.
And Dooley, you'd put this after facility?
Yes.
Okay.
The economic recession has significantly affected the financial condition of that Lansing facility, I would like to add, and that in turn would affect its valuation as an income property for tax purposes.
That's friendly.
Mike?
That's fine.
Okay. Thank you. All set, Dooley?
Thank you.
Peter?
From the beginning of when I first heard of this issue, it bothered me. I didn't like it. And I've since spent some time trying to understand what goes into it, and I've gotten less concerned. And I guess what bothered me in the beginning was the feeling that it was completely arbitrary, that there were no standards. It was just a negotiation of how much each side was willing to give. I feel that much less strongly after understanding from Joe and from others exactly what goes into it. But I'm still left, and I'll vote for this, but at the next round, it seems to me that at least I would be a whole lot more comfortable if some of the arbitrariness that's left in it were taken out, and a couple of things I'm thinking about, is I don't understand the logic of the ramp up and the ramp down. I think everybody else pays taxes based on what the current situation is, and I don't really understand why this is any different. And I would like to have people consider whether they simply should not pay taxes on whatever they agree is the value of the property at this particular time. That's one thing. And the second thing is I saw the model that Joe had, and most of the numbers that went into that model were facts. They weren't opinions. Some of them were opinions. And I would be much more comfortable with a model where there was an agreement on both parts as to precisely what goes into it and where their opinions, to try to think through a way that it wasn't your negotiating opinion, but for instance, if you're talking about the future value, that I don't know, you maybe there are some places where futures are sold in things that allow you to get a number that's printed elsewhere, where it isn't just an agreement that's struck between two parts, to make the determination and then leave the role of future negotiations for changing the formula if people think the formula is wrong, not changing the numbers when they think that the current numbers have been superseded by other values. So I would much prefer that because it's a lot harder to argue. It's their numbers and they give an answer, and lots of times you don't like what the answer is, but at least you feel good if there is a real reason why that is taken to be the answer at this time. So,
Joe, do you want to take a stab at that?
I think to the extent that we could, we did rely on facts that were known. There are some things, particularly, Peter, as you try to project forward. And the basis of this formula is a couple years back, the present, and 1 year in the future. And it's that 1 year in the future where there can be differences of opinion about what might be. And to the extent, I think, that there's negotiation on numbers, it's that predictive number. You know, what will the price of energy be a year from now? What do we plug into that part of the formula? So perhaps that can get better with more experience in these negotiations. But I do think the number of judgments that are in this formula are fairly small. Again, I'm sure we can get better with experience at doing this, but I think more than most pilots I've seen in my many days, this is a very fact-based approach to valuation.
Could I just make one comment on that? I understand, but for instance, with a guess as to what fuel prices are going to be, there's a way you can look up in the paper what futures are selling for a barrel of Texas Sweet or whatever it's called. And, you know, one could agree on just checking the futures market to make that prediction, which I think is a lot firmer way of making it than arguing with somebody on the other side of the table as to what you think. But I'm not insisting. I'm just raising this issue. At least I, for one, would be happier if there were an agreed-upon formula where the numbers just go in and they are all gotten out of reading the financial page of the Wall Street Journal.
I mean, that's a good suggestion. Just a second, Pam. And I appreciate that. I will say that one of the biggest areas of uncertainty is risk, which is really how much, you know, what do you think will happen with federal legislation on that may affect coal plants? So, you know, that's mostly an area of opinion, I think. But anything else, Joe?
No.
Okay. Pam and then Dooley?
Well, I just was going to suggest that we talk about what's in front of us now, and that I think that it's great to have suggestions of ways that we could do this differently in the future. But we need to get through this resolution right now, and I would hope that that's where we focus our time. Thank you.
Dooley?
I just wanted to offer Peter two other items that are hard to be sure about. One is weather, and the other is the economy. and they both affect demand, which affects what income the company may have.
Wait a minute. Will was next, and then Pat and Jim. Okay.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
You got distracted.
I didn't hear.
I distracted Martha.
Was I supposed to answer something? Okay.
Doesn't require a response.
Will.
Thank you, Martha. A couple things I think we should be very clear on. This body does not actually have the real say in this. All we are essentially doing is endorsing what we feel should be the direction of the IDA. So in voting tonight, we are actually not voting. We don't have the power to accept or reject this. But I think it's also fair to say that there's probably no one in this room that actually likes what we are doing. It is deeply, deeply painful. And it's not something that any of us arrived with enthusiasm, but I think our negotiating committee proceeded very, very carefully, spent a very long time trying to come up with a reasonable agreement. I credit Pat and all the people that have painstakingly tried to explain a very, very complex issue to all of us, and I think it's done a very, very good job. I did want to tell about one other person that spoke at today's hearing, which I forgot to mention before. A gentleman asked, what's the lifespan of this plant? And he, I gather, had been a long-time Lansing resident and remembered when it came online and remembered that it had a lifespan of about 50 years. Well, it's been more than that now. Jerry Goodnow answered, basically you didn't quite know. And having toured the plant with Pat a few weeks ago, I became aware of how essentially the plant's being constantly rebuilt, and they've done every attempt to keep it modern. But the lifespan of that is truly an unknowable. And as somebody who cares about the environment, I do not want us to be relying on coal very much longer. I don't think it's good for any of us. But I also know that if that plant ceases to be, its value as a taxable asset drops to nearly nothing. So we have a short-term interest in keeping that plant viable. We have a long-term interest in keeping it viable so that it can transition to a cleaner form of generation. And there have been discussions along the way of ways this can be done. And I certainly hope that if we decide to recommend to the IDA that it grant this new pilot and this pilot revision, that we will continue to encourage the development of better alternatives at that plant.
Thank you. Well, Jim, did I see your hand again?
You did. I would request that we have a roll call vote for this, even though it is an advisory opinion.
Okay. Pat?
I had planned to say a few more things than I'm going to, because it would be hard to be more eloquent than Will and some of the other people that have already spoken ahead of me. I do want to say that this has been quite a challenge for me, being new on the legislature, particularly to walk into this and have such an immediately challenging situation. And I greatly appreciate the support of Martha and staff people, Joe, Jay, all of the other folks who have talked to me and given me information, helped me come up to speed so that I can talk to Piedmont and Lansing with some reasonable sense that I know what I'm talking about. It's been very difficult for me to make a decision as to how I was going to vote tonight, and I've received some strong advice from various people about what I should do, people that I respect a great deal. And I am going to support this resolution. I think, as Will said, this is painful. This is not something that the taxpayers in Lansing are going to be able to handle very easily. They have there's other factors that are influencing budget out there that are going to compound the problem that this will present to the school district. Nevertheless, after spending all these hours studying it and gathering all the information I have been able to gather on it, it's very clear to me that at this point in time, given the situation that we are dealing with, to do anything else but to support this resolution would not be in the best interest of the taxpayers of the entire county or the taxpayers of Lansing, because the alternative would leave us with a very high likelihood that the value of the plant would be set at a figure that would be even less than it is in the pilot and would result in even less tax revenue coming this year in 2010. I think that there have been some good suggestions made, and I know that the negotiators will take those things very seriously and looking forward. This has been a unique thing that we've done here, and I think that we need to give ourselves credit. I haven't done any of it, but the people that worked on it have really done something that's unique here in New York State, as I understand, and I think that as we move forward, we can probably refine the process and take some of these suggestions into consideration. So I will be supporting this tonight.
Thank you, Pat. Anybody else? I just want to echo the appreciation of Pat's work on this. I want to remind folks that the IDA meeting is February 24th at 3:30 in the old jail. If the public has any comments, they can send them to TCAD, 200 East Buffalo Street. And if the public still has more questions, our January 19th meeting, our legislature meetings are all on, all on the web. You can watch over and over again if you like. The January 19th meeting, Jim Blizzard broke into two pieces, and if you just click on part two, that starts with the beginning of the presentation that we had with Joe and Jerry Goodnow and Steve Witcher. So that's available if anybody's still looking for more information. So. All right, we're ready for a roll call vote.
Ms. Herrera?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Lane?
Yes.
Ms. McAsee?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Proto?
Yes.
Ms. Pryor?
Yes.
Mr. Robinson?
Yes.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Yes.
Mr. Stein?
Yes.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
I guess I'm going to achieve my aim of not sending a unanimous vote, so no.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Ms. Robertson?
Yes.
14 ayes, 1 no.
Thank you all very much. So let's turn back to the regular order of the agenda. So I think we're up to me. I have a number of things on the chair's report. I got a letter. You may remember that Joe has sent a letter off to our state legislators asking for them to consider our boilerplate kinds of approval resolutions, this mortgage recording tax and other things that they always approve, but they approve at the end of the session. He asked that they move those to the beginning of the session. We got a letter from Senator Nzolio that said, thanks very much. I'll talk about this with my colleagues. So I don't know if you've gotten any other response. Okay. Yesterday I was invited to the meeting with Senator Chuck Schumer at the Transonic, and that was a very interesting event. It was in the paper today, and I was part of a small group meeting with him about economic development. So my bullet points, real fast, I had my 2.5 minutes. I talked about gas drilling. I said that we in this county did not believe it was would be an economic boon to New York State, and he vigorously nodded. I thanked him for supporting the FRAC Act at the federal level, which would remove the exemption from the Safe Drinking Water Act for oil and gas industries. I mentioned milk prices, that farmers need to, if we could just support milk prices in a more effective way, then the agricultural community in upstate would do much better. And I talked a bit about fair trade, about the difficulty of any competition trying to compete with companies overseas that pay $5 a day and throw their industrial waste just sort of out the back door. That was actually a story told to me by a businessman at NYSAC last week. So that's what Hewlett Packard does in the Philippines. So I said that was not something that taxpayers either could or should try to compete with. So those are some of the things that I brought to the table with the senator. Well, there was a story in the paper today about, again, with IDAs, that the state is imposing a tax on IDAs. So Chemung County officials decry latest tax on IDAs. I want you to know that our local IDA will have to pay the state $35,907 this year. I'm not sure for what. For services. So that is NYSAC is opposing that, and we're kind of hoping that we can get that overturned. At NYSAC, I wanted to report that, there was already a lot of conversation about it, but one piece of information. I went to the Public Safety Committee meeting, and we had talked last year about the maintenance of effort requirement for assigned counsel, and we'd put together a resolution asking the state to recalculate, to change the rules on this partnership that we have with the state. The NYSAC has negotiated with the governor to actually do that. They have, let me try to get this right. So the governor's executive budget includes creating a new Office of Indigent Defense at the state level. It'll be overseen by a board that includes some representatives nominated by NYSAC, and there will be performance-based standards, grants to counties who try to meet these standards, and the current maintenance of effort requirements will be eliminated. So then there will be a cap on local expenses for assigned counsel. So according to, you know, if this goes through, that will mean that basically the expenses that, I'm not sure exactly what the formula is, I think it is that the expenses that we incur right, you know, this year, or maybe it's an average of a couple of years, will be capped and the state will pick up the difference. So that's kind of exciting. So, Jim?
One question, Martha. During the Schumer talk, was there any discussion at all about Medicaid and the Fed funding of Medicaid at the level that they're doing? Or
he mentioned that he's fighting for, whether it's stimulus funding or whatever you're going to call it, that the federal budget include FMAP, another FMAP boost for the 2011 fiscal year, and I think our local share would be a million?
About $1 million.
So, and it really is thanks to Senator Schumer that money comes to the counties that pay a local share, because originally it was just going to go to states, and he raised his hand and said, hey, counties pay some of this cost too. So, Frank?
Martha, I want to clarify something that you mentioned about the gas drilling, if you'd bear with me a second. I know that we passed a resolution here that basically asks that all of the questions that we have asked be answered, and perhaps a slight delay in, or even a revision or even a revisit or even a recasting of the draft environmental impact statement that the DEC put out be done before anything moves forward. And there's we had a baleful of questions. I do not remember, and let me finish before you say anything, I do not remember this body saying anything about we don't want any drilling here. I think there are certain individuals who have taken that position, and I want to commend Ed Marks for the presentation that he made at NYSAC, which the PowerPoint of which is up on the Planning Department's website. Even he was careful to characterize or not to characterize it as no drilling. It was, if we're going to do this, we've got to make sure that it's done right. So I want to make sure that, please don't misunderstand me, but I want to make sure that Senator Schumer didn't go away with the impression that this body, you were there as the county legislative chair. I don't know how you addressed that particular question, but I want to make sure that if he's listening tonight, and I'm sure he is, that this body hasn't passed a resolution saying we don't want any drilling here. I think what we passed was we want to make sure that if there is drilling, I think the way Ed characterized it at NYSEC, frankly what I've heard and what I read and what I saw in that PowerPoint, is more to what this body, the position this body took as a body. And that basically, that's where I am. I mean, there's a lot of unanswered questions, but I don't think that we've taken a position that says no drilling.
Fair enough, Frank. My point with him was that...
Maybe I really did mishear, so...
Well, since we were talking, I didn't say anything. I didn't say no drilling. I didn't say I haven't come out for a statewide ban or anything like that. But the strongest reason people give forward for promoting drilling is that it will be an economic benefit.
That's where I am.
And I think there's a sentiment here that if you look at the cost as well as the benefit to some people, the costs are greater than the benefits. Well, and certainly the jobs are not local jobs.
So we've been consistent, and I think this board has been very consistent. I know that the EMC and the Water Resources Council, the Planning Committee, we have asked consistently for show us where the economic benefits are going to be. And I think that's a legitimate question. And there's enough data, I think, nationwide from other sites, as you mentioned before, that can give some background on that. And I for one, am going to continue to ask, show us, let's be for Missouri for a change. Show us where the economic benefits are. And it can't be like the IDA claiming that it's creating jobs when they're creating construction jobs, and then there are no permanent jobs once the last construction trailer leaves the site. This is similar to that, in my opinion. If an IDA project is creating permanent jobs as well as the temporary construction ones, that's fine. But let's hold their feet to the fire. Let's hold the feet to the fire of the state to show us where are the permanent jobs, where are the permanent economic benefits once the last drilling rig is sunk and these people that are wildcatters are gone. Those jobs are going to come into the area or wherever they're drilling, maybe not here, quickly. But once they're gone, those people will move on to the next area. Anyway, thank you.
There was a report on the desk by Jeffrey Jaquette, on the desk out in the lobby. Jeffrey Jaquette, who also spoke at NYSEC. It's called Boomtown. I can't remember the subtitle. And his point is that 90% of the jobs go to people from outside the state.
Exactly.
So, Mike?
Martha, I caught wind of this IDA tax just yesterday, and you brought it up here. $35,000 is a huge hit to our little IDA. I don't understand the mechanism here, how it's assessed. Did they explain that to you?
4.7% of our gross revenue. So, let us see. There are monitoring services that the State Controller's Office provides. We send annual reports into the state, and they chew it up and send back a compilation and say this is how the state's IDAs have done in terms of jobs produced and other measures. So,
can that be passed through to the recipients? Maybe that's unfair. Maybe you don't know. It's so new here. I know, but I'm scratching my head. I read an article about a city that had just been charged $49,000 on its IDA, and this is very troublesome. The idea is to try to get more money out there for projects. Right. As I recall, $35,000 would gobble up about the almost the annual payment every year that we got from Lake Source Cooling.
Yeah, I'm not sure the mechanism. I'm not sure what we can do to fight it. But Pam?
Well, I was just going to add that the income for the IDA came from the bonding. Much of the income came from the bonding that we used to do, and the state has taken away the ability of the IDA to bond. So it I mean, it just sounds like they're trying to destroy the IDAs is what it sounds like.
Frank.
What's the status?
This is just the chair's report.
That's okay, but what's the status of NYSAC's review? Because everybody's going to be concerned about the same thing Mike described. We just aren't going to pay, we're not going to advise just paying a bill because we received the bill.
Well, it may be the sort of thing that if we don't pay it, they take it from somewhere else. I don't know the details, but we'll certainly find out more and bring them to you. I will let you know that we got some handouts that I'll put over on the top of the mailboxes. This is a summary of the legislative resolutions that NYSAC passed, and they're just kind of one-liners, but you get a sense of what the resolutions were that came out of our committees. They did a budget survey about of counties, and that's very interesting information about what 2010 adopted budgets look like across the state. And then there are a couple documents about the state budget, the executive budget, that I'll put on top of the mailboxes there as well. And two more things, really, very quickly. I'm also going to put this Legislative Gazette. This comes out every week. Okay. And the second page is our several articles about the drilling rally, the dueling rallies on hydrofracking in Albany, January 25th, that several of us went to. So finally, it has come to our attention that we really need a focus for discussion of issues related to broadband development. And Paula asked me, well, where should this go and who should be looking at this? And Mike Lane has graciously accepted that as part of the GEO committee's charge for the year, because I know that there are at least two kind of current initiatives that Paula is working on and that we're sort of looking at. So I'm very happy to say that GEO will be handling that this year. Okay. Thank you. Good. County Administrator's report.
Thanks, Martha. Mindful of your time, I'll go very quickly tonight. A lot of what I plan to report on relates to the NYSAC conference, and I think you've heard much of what would have been in my report. Very quickly through some of the areas that I participated in, I went to a session that was presented by the former state budget director, and I went to a session that was presented by the current state budget director. Both agree that the state's problems will be with the state for the next 3 years at least. It looks like the state budget sets up kind of the way we've been discussing over the past few weeks, where there's a $7 billion gap they're trying to fill this year, and if they do that, they have another $7 billion gap on top of that to fill next year, and if they fix that, they have another $7 billion gap the following year to work on. So they certainly have their work cut out for them. I think the question is where they're going to go to fill those significant gaps in their budget, and I don't think anybody in Albany had an answer to that question. Again, we've all become very good at defining the problem statement. We didn't hear many solution statements that came out of the conference in Albany. I also attended a presentation on the pension situation by the New York State Comptroller's Office, confirming that basically also what we've been saying is that we should expect our pension rates to increase in each of the next 5 years. The conversation went to the amortization plan, which is the ability that's been proposed by both the governor and the comptroller, although in different forms, to be able to borrow to take care of some of the spike in pension costs that are foreseen over the next few years. We are putting a pencil to that. We will have some projections on that relatively soon. I will tell you that a different interest rate was put put forward at this meeting than what we heard David and I a couple of weeks ago, where if we are going to amortize our pensions, it will be at an interest rate of 8% as opposed to 5%, which is what we heard a couple of weeks ago. So I don't know whether there's confusion in Albany about what the interest rate's going to be or competing plans, but clearly at the session I attended last week, the interest rate was 8%. This is a real important public policy discussion we will be having over the next probably couple of months about how we should approach that. Lastly, I'm on the Resolutions Committee. I have a greater appreciation for the work that Dooley and Frank have done in Rules. I sat through 4 hours of painstaking review of a lot of resolutions, supporting the things that help us, opposing the things that hurt us. I was going to flag the maintenance of effort issue that Martha talked about, which is a centerpiece part of that resolution package. I will also tell you that another thing that NYSAC is lobbying for through this package of resolutions is to eliminate this 2-year renewal of the extra 1% sales tax that we go through every couple of years and bite our nails, hoping that the state will approve, as they always do at the end of session. NYSAC has suggested, as they have before, that reality be accepted. Most counties are currently at 4%, so let it stay there without the 2-year renewal process. So those were the major items of the NYSAC conference that I attended. Lastly, I will tell you that we've talked about increasing the county's capacity to identify, to analyze, and to apply for grants and then manage them, that a pipeline of revenue over the next several years is going to be probably the federal government. We need to get better at drawing down that money. Kind of as a case study over the past couple of weeks, Paula Younger, who I've asked on my staff to get involved in this, has been working with Solid Waste to go after a new grant, a $200,000 grant through NYSERDA to divert basically food waste from the waste stream. Great example of a team effort from Solid Waste and Paula to identify this source of grant money, to put an application, to do it with hours to spare for the deadline, and hopefully we will be successful in competing for that. And I hope that's an example of work that we will be able to do more of in the near future. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Carol.
Yeah, I have a question for Joe on the this pension amortization issue. And my question is, do you think that it's something that we should do more than learn about over the next few months about how it will be handed down to us, the instruction to do it or the allowance to do it, as opposed to something that we might want to consider learning about more quickly and weighing in on? Barbara Lifton mentioned it in her town hall meeting just very briefly, and we didn't discuss it. But I have big questions about It just doesn't make any sense to me about the pros and cons. It doesn't make any sense to me that you would how do you amortize a cost that is just going to keep getting worse? And maybe eventually if we end pensions or cut pensions for younger people, 25, 30 years down the road, you might see a difference, but we're not going to see that in the next 10 years. So to amortize, I just don't get it. And so do we want to do more than learn about it? Do we want to
I think we probably need to sit down and really dissect the issue. This is based on the belief that the pension costs are going to go up and then come back down. So the notion is you can take that sharp peak off of that trend line by borrowing for that spike in pension costs and then smoothing out those costs over time. Now, you raise an excellent question. What if? What if those pension costs aren't going to go back down? What if they stay elevated? And then we've incurred both debt and high pension costs. So what we owe you is a number of scenarios to show you how this might look and might work, given your assumptions about what may happen in the future and interest rates and all that. So that's where we hope to go quickly.
Peter.
When you say the pension costs are going to go down, does that mean the rate of rise of the pension costs or the annual costs themselves are going to go down? And if indeed it's the latter, that the annual cost is going to go down, then it sounds to me like they're overcharging. Why then are they going up now if they believe that their formulas are showing that they're going to go down? Doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. This is a great committee discussion. There were losses incurred when the economy collapsed that will be recovered by the pension fund over the next 5 years. So that's why our rates will stay elevated and, in fact, increase over the next 5 years. The belief is, though, that as those monies are recovered and the pension fund regains its equilibrium, our pension costs will go back down. So currently we're spending about 11.5% of our payroll on pensions. The state now expects that's going to rise to 23.5% over the next 3 years. The state then projects that after we get through with that growth path, we will come back down to about 11% of payroll a year again. So it is just in the eyes of the state controller's office, a temporary but very sharp increase in pension costs that will decline over time.
It's inversely related to the stock market. So when the stock market crashed in early 2009, that's why our costs had to go up, and that's why they're baked in, because essentially we have to pay back the losses so that income won't be available when the pensions are required to be paid.
Yeah, we owe you a really good explanation of this at probably a budget and capital committee meeting and really go through it.
Okay, I'm going to do something a little unusual. I'm going to call a recess for 5 minutes. And the reason I'm doing it right now is that our dear Jim Blizzard said if you do that at 7:30, it's easier for him with the CDs and the DVDs and whatever. So a shout out to Jim. I hope I made the 7:30 mark. So if we can come back in 5 minutes, I think that would give everybody a breath of fresh air.
Does this comply with the rules?
Absolutely.